Welcome to Bubble Trouble, conversations between the independent analyst Richard Kramer, that's me, and the economist and author Will Page, where we lay out some inconvenient truths about how financial markets really work. We have a fantastic guest for today, the author of Choke Point Capitalism, and we're going to have a discussion with the inimitable Cory Doctorow over two parts. The first, we're going to focus on market structures and monopsony. We'll get our head around that word. And then the second, we're going to dig deep into copyright and how artists can take back control of their precious works. Cory is a prolific author, speaker, and activist, and we're delighted to have him with us today. More in a moment. We have an extremely special guest today that I'm really thrilled to have with us because I have read many of his science fiction books, and indeed my teenage son was an avid reader of many of his young adult science fiction books for many years. We have the inimitable Cory Doctorow, who has just published a new book called Choke Point Capitalism, which is really very much on point with our thinking about bubble trouble. I'm not going to go through the long list of all of Cory's accolades and his roles and all that stuff. He's already declaiming that for the moment. But I do remember one personal story, which is he gave a reading at a comic store, which is now defunct in London, called Orbital Comics. And I took my then 11-year-old son along to get a signed copy of the graphic novel that he had just published. And Cory was a true gentleman then, and he is a real gentleman to come join us on his book tour.
Orbital
now.
Was such a lovely store. I'm so sad to see it's gone.
It is a lovely, sad departure from Soho. So, Cory, just as a quick starter, can you give people a sense of where they can find your stuff? You're not someone who's a shrinking violet and hard to find. And a little bit about what prompted you to write Choke Point Capitalism.
So if you go to pluralistic.net, that's got links to all the ways you can find me. I write an essay more or less every day about topics in the news. I've been a blogger for 20 years. And then that goes out as a Twitter feed, a Mastodon feed, a Tumblr feed, a Medium feed, an RSS feed, newsletter, and so on. Wherever it's on a platform I control, there's no surveillance, no metrics, no advertising. And all those links are at pluralistic.net. In terms of Choke Point Capitalism, I should note that the lead author on this book is not me. It's my colleague, Rebecca Giblin, a brilliant law professor from the University of Melbourne, who has done some of the most important empirical work on how copyright interacts with artists' incomes. And Rebecca and I are both veterans of the copyright wars. We had spent decades arguing about whether copyright should be longer, broader, wider, and what the distributional effects of that would be, whether that would make anyone more money, and if so, who that would make more money for. And we had observed that for 40 years, really, since the 1976 Copyright Act in the United States, copyright had increased in duration, increased in scope, more works could be copyrighted, more kinds of works. The statutory damages had gotten higher. The ease with which you could prove that you were entitled to statutory damages got easier. The industries that make use of copyright had gotten more profitable. But the artists whose labor created the works had gotten a smaller and smaller share of that money, both in real terms and proportionally. Their incomes were declining. And we did a presentation together when I was out on a book tour in Melbourne. And we were in the back of a cab and we were talking about this. And we decided that this was the real crux of the matter, that people had decided in the kind of great battle that you could either be on team tech or you could be on team content. But you had to choose a side. And there wasn't a team artist. And we thought that there could be a team artist. And as we looked at the way these markets are structured, we came to the conclusion that the reason that copyright was making the industries bigger but not helping their workforce was the same reason that if you give your kids more lunch money, it will make the bullies who steal their lunch money every day richer but won't get them fed. And the fact that the bullies are out there demanding that kids get more lunch money because they're going hungry doesn't mean that there is an amount of lunch money that will eventually benefit those kids. And we called the bullies at the gate, we called them the choke point operators, and we set out to examine how the rigged markets work and to come up with very detailed technical proposals for how to unrig them.
And I guess choke point capitalism rolls off the tongue a little bit better than monopsony rents.
Yeah, or gopsonistic conduct.
Yes, yes. You know. I have been explaining the concept of monopsony to various people, but it just doesn't have that kind of grab you off the shelf kind
of. It sure doesn't. Well, we never had a life-ruining board game called Monopsony.
No, we didn't.
So nobody had the opportunity to become familiar with with that term and as they did with monopoly. But, you know, monopsony is a market where buyers have power.
Yep.
And intuitively, that might seem a little weird. But then you go, well, wait a second. If you're an author and there's only five major publishers, there might only be four pretty soon, depending on whether Simon & Schuster, Random House win their appeal. Then anything you want to sell to readers has to go through these very powerful buyers who decide how much you're going to get paid and then how your work is going to get marketed. And it's very hard to get around them.
Yeah, I'm going to throw the baton over to Will because he is an absolute, he's been deep in the weeds of the copyright issues for many years. And I think he's just raring to, to dig in on this.
Also, but just on monopsony, we have this uber hipster blog called Stratechery, Ben Thompson. And he has about 250,000 followers of his blog. And he talks again and again about aggregation theory. And unless I'm missing something, he's just talking about a monopsony.
Yeah.
But he's put lipstick on a pig. I mean, it's not sexy term. So we call it aggregation theory. We present it as a whole new thing. Is that how you see
it? Orthodoxy for 40 years has become more and more welcoming of corporate power and really oriented around this idea that there live among us kind of genetic sports who have the special genius that it would take to make us all better off, and that when they, given their reign, they grow these gigantic empires. And the last thing we want to do is put those empires in chains, because then we don't reap the benefit of like little Jeffy Bezos and his overnight delivery machine. And you hear it being said in a very open way now. Whenever Warren Buffett is declaring his unslakable lust for businesses with wide, unbridgeable moats, he's just talking about monopsony. When Peter Thiel says competition is for losers, he's saying, well, like, why should I have to bid against some lesser man with less vision than me to acquire the inputs for my firm when I am clearly the smartest guy in the room? And if I'm given my free rein, then I don't have to waste money that I could otherwise spend on, I don't know, tormenting migrants with night vision scopes or whatever. And I'll be able to make us all better off, except for those migrants that he torments with night vision scopes.
And certainly, we had a previous guest named Kurt Anderson, who's written a brilliant book called Fantasyland and also one called Evil Geniuses about the 30 to 40 year effort to get that mode of thinking accepted in popular discourse. The idea that from Milton Friedman's initial stuff about, oh, well, stakeholder capitalism, the only obligation a firm has is to make as much money as they possibly can, externalities be damned. And that we've had a decades-long sweep of history of concentration. And this was one of the areas I wanted to start off with, because a lot of the what you describe in the creator world, in the artist world, and what's happened to them, don't we just at a higher level see this all over the place? Whether it's big finance and big oil and big pharma and the concentration of so many industries, hasn't this just been a, you're examining one outcome of this trend towards gigantism that there was... When I grew up, I thought the Tyrannosaurus was the biggest ever dinosaur, but who knew? There's a Gigantosaurus that's even bigger. And you could always make larger entities, which are theoretically more efficient. Aren't we just looking at one part of that elephant?
So you're right that this is part of a wider trend. And in fact, part of our theory change in this book is that artists, frankly, just aren't important enough to change this stuff on our own, but that the circumstances that artists find ourselves in are really related to the circumstances that lots of other workers find themselves in, and their scope for solidarity across sectors. That's how we get stuff done. Creators do have a couple of distinctive circumstances that make them particularly vulnerable to this. So one is that creators create for reasons that are unrelated to theories of rational economics.
Correct. There was creativity before there was copyright.
Yeah, there certainly was, right? I mean, remember that books are older than copyright, than commerce, than paper, than binding. One of the things that just freaks me out when people talk about, well, it's an ebook and here are the licensing terms and they say that you can't do this and you can't do that. I'm like, what kind of jumped up 10-second-year-old infant are you to tell me that my ancient medium needs to be bound by terms of service that was invented for DOS? This is this is something old and sacred, not some modern bit of commerce for you to so blithely dismiss of. But We know the joke about the kid who runs away and joins the circus, and his dad finds him shoveling elephant poop, and he says, son, come home, and the kid says, what, and quit show business? People make art because they can't stop. So creators aren't alone in doing their job for exogenous reasons, for reasons unrelated to their compensation. And wherever we find people who work out of a sense of mission, we often find exploitative work arrangements. So think of healthcare workers, people who work with young children, people who work with elderly people and disabled people and so on, who are often subjected to very bad circumstances. And effectively, their bosses are saying, I dare you to leave these people to die or suffer.
Right.
I'm going to cut your wages and let's see who blinks first. And that's heavy. Yeah. Yeah, well,
but it's true.
The teachers in Ontario just did this too, and the Tories there blinked. But, you know, my friend David Graeber, who died during the pandemic, he wrote a brilliant book called Bullshit Jobs.
Yeah.
And one of the points of that book is that in a world in which so much of the work that we do, it contributes so little to anything that anyone cares about, that we assign a kind of perverse premium to jobs that are satisfying. We say, how could you possibly want a higher wage? Aren't you satisfied by doing something that matters? Surely it's only people who like tick boxes or fill out a rectangle on the org chart to make some princeling at a multinational feel big. Those people are the people who need to be well compensated. Otherwise, what would they have in their lives? But, you know, the other thing...
You know why you earn in a year what an investment banker earns in a month? Because you want to do this.
That's right. You're getting the intrinsic satisfaction of wiping the bums of dying people, whereas they have to put in the hard work of going to Nobu for lunch every day. So the other thing I think that makes creators vulnerable is that the mechanism by which creators are meant to extract a higher share of the revenue from their work, copyright, is extremely sensitive to market concentration, and it accelerates market concentration. So copyright in a creator's hand it is only good to the extent that there are a lot of buyers, that they're not a monopsonistic environment. Copyright in the hands of monopsonists can be used to corner and structure future markets. And I know you have a history with Spotify. We have a couple of chapters on Spotify, I'm sure you saw in the book, where we talk about the fact that the big three labels controlled 70% of the recorded music when Spotify was kicking off, meant that Spotify had to build a service to the specifications of the big three labels. So they got to build their own future. And there are many ways that we document in the book that future that they built was detrimental to new market entrants. Things like most favored nation deals that didn't come with big fat equity packages that the labels were able to extract from Spotify. So everybody's getting a low per stream rate that makes the IPO pop big, but only the big three have got shares that blow up when the IPO comes.
The big four, Merlin, the collective
Merlin, you're right.
Had equity too.
That's right.
We're going to take it to the break now. This conversation is in full flow, covering market dynamics, and we'll be back after the break to delve deeper into this very, very interesting topic. Well, I definitely want to come in on that debate about the distribution and the long tail, because it's an interesting one. I mean, I've been debunking the long tail theory since 2008. You may remember I published a piece of work which made me no fans, but I showed that there was 30 million tracks on the download store shelf, 10 million of which had no click. 80% of choice was a dormant long tail. Mm-hmm. And of those which had a click, it was even more hit heavy than in the physical world. Mm. And that, to a certain extent, has continued. And I guess the long story short on that one is it does seem to me that when you offer more choice, people want more hits. And Richard, you talk about the paradox of choice here. Let's try and wrestle a minute with the supply and demand factors on this issue. Do you see the winner takes all being a function of supply? There's just too much choice? Or is it a function of demand and who controls demand?
See, I think it's a function of regulatory forbearance, right? Mm-hmm. I think it's very hard to dissonate. In fact, on the way over, I was emailing on the train down from Edinburgh. I was emailing with an antitrust lawyer I know here in the city who were talking about structural separation and the idea that you can have these platform markets where firms are on both sides of a sale, and how it's very hard to know whether they're cheating. When Google says, well, we put a thing that belongs to us at the top of the Google search rank, but we did it because we genuinely believe it's the best thing, how do you figure out whether they're telling the truth? And if they are telling the truth as they understand it, how do you figure out whether they're right? Unless you've got a front row seat in Plato's cave, you don't know.
You inspired another thought there, Corey. I'm grateful for it. But if we look at Facebook, and I want to get into Facebook as we go further into this podcast, we're going to have a competition of who called out Facebook first. And I checked the dates. We went in March. I think you went in February. So you bask in the glory of told you so, why their stock's in the toilet. With Facebook, here's another really good example for you to mull over, Corey, which is if Facebook say the cost of that ad space to me is worth X, that is, if I want to use that banner ad inventory to promote Oculus headsets, I determine the market value of that internal advert, which is a reservation wage that the rest of the market has to compete against. And if I cook my books and inflate that number higher than the real market average should be, then back to monopsonistic power, it's using market power to force the cost of advertising to everyone else above what would be a natural equilibrium. My own brand is worth far more than I know it is because that's how I'm going to present it to the market.
And you're getting at something really important here, which is the administratability of policy, right? If we say to firms, all right, you're allowed to corner important markets, but you have to promise that you're not going to cheat. It's really hard to figure out whether they're cheating.
Scouts honor.
Yeah.
Scouts honor regulation.
I think if you look at an even more concrete example, there was the incredibly telling moment in the House subcommittee testimony of 2020 where Jeff Bezos was asked about whether he ever observed the pricing or sales of third-party merchants on his platform to inform what he might do in his first party products. Mm-hmm. And there was an obvious that kind of aha moment where he said, well, I'm not really sure, I'll have to get back to you. But of course, that is, especially on a platform like Amazon, which has a very clear rule which says, thou shalt not sell for less somewhere else than you sell on our own platform. And tying that in with your point, which is if Jeff Bezos knows how much he can charge for a first party product, then that effectively sets the market price for all third-party products, especially if he knows he's going to aggregate a very high portion of demand.
Jeff Bezos might have genuinely believed that he wasn't doing it, but his organization itself was so big and riddled with conflicts that it could very easily have been an executive at Amazon. And if you've seen any of the reports on Amazon's internal data handling practices, they're very much a move fast and break things company. Until recently, they had no audit logs of who had copies of all of their data. Internal teams would just spin up and say, we've got an idea for a product. And the first thing they would do is make a copy of all of Amazon's customer data, all of Amazon's merchant data to start working with it. There was no logs of where it was going. There was insider threats. There was sales of this data to marketplace sellers to gain advantage over other marketplace sellers, sales to third parties. There were leaks, all kinds of things, all in the service of growing very quickly. So the idea that Jeff Bezos can even know is very hard. So this is not distinct to Amazon. There are lots of circumstances in which someone is meant to be the referee, right? Is meant to run a fair game where even though it might be efficient and simple and even sometimes better to let them be the referee, like think of how easy it would be if you and your soon-to-be ex-wife could both use the same lawyer in your divorce, right? You wouldn't have to copy all those papers. You'd save more money. When you were done, the divorce estate would have more money. We all understand why there's two lawyers in this arrangement. I remember when I first moved to London, I lived near you. I lived in Kentish Town, and my landlord at the flat I was renting said, well, you have to go down to Foxton's to negotiate the lease. And I went down to Foxton's to negotiate the lease, and they said, all right, we need some money from you because we're going to negotiate the lease for you. And I said, well, who do you negotiate it with? And they said, well, us. Right? And it was unsurprisingly a very bad lease because my landlord paid them 100x over the life of that flat more than I ever would. This doesn't take Milton Friedman sitting there and saying incentives matter to understand why this is a bad deal. And historically, the way that we regulated large structurally important firms that had to be referees is we told them they couldn't participate in the game.
Right.
If you owned a bank, you couldn't own a business that competed with the businesses you were lending money to for just like totally obvious reasons. I'm running Corey's Pizzeria, and right next to me is Barclays Pizzeria, and we both borrow from Barclays for our capital, and I need to buy a new pizza oven, and Barclays Pizzeria needs to buy a new oven, but Barclays Pizzeria gets their loan interest-free, and mine comes at a 6% loan, 6% with high penalties if I miss a single payment. I'll go out of business, Barclays Pizzeria won't. And eventually Barclays owns all the pizzerias, right? trains weren't allowed to own freight companies. The idea that we have Amazon, Apple, Google all sitting in these positions where they are platform users and platform owners, and where they keep getting caught with their hands in the cookie jars, right? There's been so many instances in which they've abused this power, not just in ways that are shady, but like actually illegal, that it seems like just the minimum prudent standard to say, you can be the referee or you can own a team, but you can't be both.
But let's go where the rubber hits the road in this for me. It's going to get a little bit heavy going here for our listeners, but just hold this for a second. What we're discussing here is a problem of monopsony power. But when you drop monopsony and flip it over to monopoly, that's where I think you see a slight counter case. That is, a typical monopoly, if you borrowed £9,000 to study at London School of Economics this year, would say that a monopoly restricts output and increases costs. You get that classic chart, and that's what a monopoly does. Tech monopolies, for me, do the opposite. They expand output and, to a large extent, reduce costs. So it doesn't fix the textbook definition. It doesn't fit the regulatory framework. So from a monopoly perspective, the counter-argument would be, I'm making things cheaper for the consumer, and that's what matters most. What happens back in the supply chain, well, that's good blood on the carpet capitalism. But for the consumer, they're spending less on that lawnmower. They're spending less on that tent. They're spending less on that carton of Tropicana than they would have done otherwise. And I think it's a bit of a tug of war going on there, but just walk me through how you see that.
Yeah, so I think there's two ways to think about this. One is to consider it on its own terms, and one is to consider it in a historic context. So in its own terms, the idea that consumer welfare is the only thing that matters assumes that there is a consumer who is not a worker, right? That wage suppression that comes through the supply, just through supply chain squeezes, will always be offset by lower prices. We've already seen that doesn't work. I mean, one of the reasons we've had debt-fueled consumption at increasing levels now to really unsustainable levels since the dawn of the neoliberal era is that even as the cost of hard goods was declining and services, wages weren't keeping up. They were stagnating and people had to raid the equity in their homes. They had to borrow money on their credit cards. And then that brings me to the second problem, which is the historic argument for this. So the origins of American antitrust law are in John Sherman's Sherman Act of 1890. And John Sherman stood on the floor of the Senate and didn't say a word about consumer welfare. He said if we would not permit a king to rule over us, we should not allow an autocrat of trade to rule over us. That when we allow firms to become too big to fail and too big to jail, that they're able to structure our markets in ways that are really harmful to us. So one of the things that's happened over the years that we've allowed corporate power to swell is it's made it harder to regulate wisely. And as a consequence, we've had things like a general drawdown of public services and an increasing private expense to use those services. So not only are homes more expensive because we treat them as assets and we have dysfunctional planning and so on, but you have to raid the equity in your home to send your kid to uni and also to pay for your retirement and also to pay for your health care or your long-term care. It's even worse in the United States, but it's not great here. I'm a British citizen. I lived here. My family is here. My in-laws are here. And people are hanging on to the equity in their homes with their bare fingernails if they were lucky enough to have it. And the people who weren't lucky enough to have it are on the really pointy end of this, where everybody who is trying to squeeze some income out of their homes is jacking up rents and militating for fewer tenancy protections and so on. So you create a situation when you allow corporate power to concentrate and when you allow wealth more broadly to concentrate, where the parochial interests of small numbers of people are given priority and the broad interests of large numbers of people are not. And as Piketty writes in Capital in the 21st Century, that is intrinsically destabilizing, right? That just when you need food, but you're growing ornamental flowers for these, then eventually people get hungry enough that you get bread riots, right? And so you can't allow your policy world to be dominated by just a handful of people who have all the money and all the power in the world to throw at it, because then policy becomes an auction.
But going back to that counter-argument, which is to reiterate today's tech monopolies, and there's a joke there because I'm using plural to describe monopolies, which is an oxymoron in itself.
Well, okay, let's call them entities with pricing power, which is longer than monopoly, but oligopolies. But
you could almost say, how many tech monopolies do we need to worry about before we have a problems competition? But still, on that, I did say they expand output and reduce price, which is net positive to the consumer. But let's think this through for a second. Thanks to the size and scale of these tech monopolies, in our current profession, a first-time author, a long-time established author, we're going to see a million frontlist book titles get released this year. A record, mm-hmm. a record of all time. And they're all available on Amazon.
Right.
We're going to see, we just heard Apple announce 100 million songs on their platform, far more than the 1,000 Steve Jobs promised to put in your pocket in 2002. Sure. And they're there in the touch of a piece of glass. So by having these tech monopolies on one part of the value chain, we have far more choice available to the consumer. We can debate price in a second, but would, if you follow the logic, we did something about this, would choice therefore suffer? Would lack the convenience, you would lack the choice.
Yeah, so this is a thing I call the fallacy of the inseparable offer, right? In order to get Audible, you have to have DRM that locks every book that you sell on Audible to Audible. I don't see why that's true. Google would like us to believe this, right? Google would like you to believe that in order to have a really good search engine, you have to be spied on in every conceivable way, right? Like someone came down off a mountain with two stone tablets and said, Larry, Sergey, thou must stop rotating thine log files and start mining them for actionable market intelligence. And the reality is Google was a really great search engine for half a decade before they started spying on you. Mark Zuckerberg would like you to think that in order to talk to your gran, you need to be spied on. But Facebook also didn't spy on you for half a decade. And as Dina Srivastavan writes about in the antitrust case against Facebook, Facebook built itself as the non-surveilling alternative to MySpace. That was their unique selling proposition when they were first coming into a broad market and leaving just the .edu market behind. So the question is, do we need to have a firm where the drivers are being maimed at 5x the rate, or the warehouse workers are being maimed at 5x the rate of other warehouse workers, where the drivers are urinating in bottles, and where there is huge city planning problems with city tax bases being eroded by demanding special favors and so on, in order to get overnight delivery, or in order to get everything that we want? Or could we imagine a version of this that was better regulated, more competitive, more decomposed into subparts rather than being unified through lots of acquisitions, where lots and lots of actors in the market would participate in order to offer the same services, but not just under one roof?
Let me just get to your point about regulatory forbearance, because you and I met in Brussels in March.
That's right.
We were in this conference with all the big beasts of European regulation.
We podcasted it. We called it the muscles in Brussels. The lack of muscles in Brussels.
Right. We did a podcast after this talking about the sanctimonious pronouncements of everyone from Verstager and Thierry Breton to Lina Khan and Jonathan Kantner, all talking tough about what they were going to do. And yet, if you go back 30 years ago to George Stigler's regulatory capture theory, it feels as if I have been trying to explain for the past 5 to 10 years why regulation remains so woefully ineffective at finding the structural separation. Now, I think there is one small side case, which is none of the big tech companies have made major acquisitions in the past 5 years because they are
scared.
Afraid of the proctological examinations which would ensue, fine. So you've slightly amended their ability to expand their footprints. But most of the structural separation you're talking about just has it's spun its wheels and gone nowhere. And I have as little hope for the DMA and the DSA in Europe as I do for some of the efforts by the House and Senate and DOJ and elsewhere. It feels as if they are outgunned and outmatched and kind of not even on the same playing field. Tell me why that view doesn't hold.
Yeah, I refuse to be a nihilist about this stuff. And we need to decompose that into a bunch of different questions. So like one is, can you make good regulation and enforce it? Well, like clearly, right? We used to get poisoned at dinner.
Yeah, food safety. Food safety is a good example.
Now we don't, right? Yeah. Building codes, just all kinds of stuff. Can we break up monopolies, even when they're much larger and more powerful than the states? We got John D. Rockefeller, right?
And we broke up the AT&T monopoly and then over 40 years slowly put it back together in two companies, not three.
So what happened with AT&T is very instructive, though, because AT&T was the last hurrah of a movement that started with the breakup of Standard Oil. And by 1982, there were two big tech antitrust investigations underway. One was IBM, one was AT&T. IBM had been in antitrust hell for 12 years. They'd outspent the DOJ antitrust division every year on outside counsel for 12 consecutive years. They called it antitrust Vietnam. Ronald Reagan sweeps into office. He's got an antitrust czar. he understands the antitrust czar. Reagan didn't understand anything, but his antitrust czar understood that these two firms were together strangling the American tech industry. It was really bad for American innovation, and America was losing its global edge, and that they needed to get rid of at least one of them. And they said, ideologically, AT&T is easier to get rid of than IBM because we can go out and tell our frothing Chicago-addled base that AT&T is a creature of government, that it was never really a company to begin with because it had this regulated monopoly status for all these years, whereas IBM is this freestanding American institution. IBM, meanwhile, 12 years of antitrust hell. You talk about the tech firms losing their nerve to go after acquisitions. After 12 years, IBM said, we're going to build a PC, but we're going to use commodity components because we know the DOJ doesn't like us owning our supply chain. We're not going to build our own operating system because the DOJ doesn't like us building our own operating system. There's that kid Bill Gates and his pal Paul Allen. They've got a company called Micro-Soft. They lost the dash after they got the contract. And we're going to get them to build it. And then this amazing, weird, queer punk technologist named Tom Jennings, who worked for Phoenix, who previously had built a thing called FidoNet, was asked by Phoenix to clone the ROM of the IBM PC, which he did. And they were like, we don't see anything. There's no problem with this. And Compaq, Gateway, Dell, they all use those ROMs to compete against IBM. A couple of decades before, IBM would have crushed them like a bug. They would have made the rubble bounce, but they let them get away with it. But then we stopped, which is why AT&T reformed.
Right.
Standard Oil did not reform into a couple of giant companies until we stopped enforcing antitrust law. There's actually there's no causal mystery here. Mm. When we tell companies that they aren't allowed to do predatory or anti-competitive mergers, they don't. And when we tell them that they can, they do.
So just come quickly in on AT&T. Also in that whole story was the story of the Carter phone.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Which is a beautiful
story attachments.
Just a dashboard radio integration into a phone which allowed you to compete at the edge.
Yep.
No Carter phone, no modem. No modem, no internet.
Yep.
So we have to tip our hat to the Carter phone for just perhaps throwing the first stone against the wall of the AT&T monopoly.
And in part two, I want to get what's currently happening with some of the tech companies, because some of them are going through some existential crises. Mm-hmm. And indeed, I know Will wants to dig into the topics of copyright and dig more into some of the topics of choke point capitalism. So we'll be back with our esteemed guest, Cory Doctorow.
Excellent.
If you're new to Bubble Trouble, we hope you'll follow the show wherever you listen to podcasts. Bubble Trouble is produced by Eric Nuzum, Jesse Baker, and Julia Natt at Magnificent Noise. Special thanks this week to Oliver Blois and Elizabeth Arnold at Platoon 7 Studios in London for helping us record this episode. You can learn more at bubbletroublepodcast.com. Until next time, on behalf of my co-host Will Page, I'm Richard Kramer.